meeting of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission at this time. It is Tuesday, October 4th, 10:30 a.m. We're at the State Capitol Building, room 412, Pierce, South Dakota. My name is Gary Hansen. With me today is Vice Chairman Bob Saar and Commissioner Dusty Johnson. First, we will check to see who is on the line with us. Danny Law of Golden West.
Here, Commissioner.
Marlene Bennett.
Mr. Chairman.
Tal Wysorek.
I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
John Burke.
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Paul Layton.
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Chris Madsen.
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Dick Augustine and Susan Stewart.
Dick Augustine here. Susan Stewart will be joining us shortly.
Thank you. Melissa Thompson.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Mark Holling.
Here, Mr. Chairman.
Colleen Savold.
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Letty Friesen.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Natalie Baker.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. And Dave Korzemp is on with me. He's our attorney.
Good morning.
Thank you. Brad Moody. Linda Walsh.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here. Thank you.
Don Ball.
We're here, Mr. Chairman. I also have Dan Koontz and Andrea Stomberg with me.
We have Brad Moody as part of your team joining us as well this morning. Do you know if he is going to be able to join us now?
He is going to join us, and I will see if he's going to be calling in right away.
All right. Your item is towards the beginning. Please let us know when I get to that. If he's not here, then I'll wish to defer that.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Dave, have you just joined us?
This is Brad.
Brad, excuse me.
Just joined on the line.
Thank you. Then we'll begin with the administrative item. This will be deferred, approving the minutes. Consumer reports. Status report on consumer utility inquiries and complaints received by the commission. Sarah.
I will be handling that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Commission has received a total of 1,306 consumer contacts during 2005. 17 of these contacts have been received since the last report was prepared for the September 27th, 2005 Commission meeting. 6 of the contacts for this period involve telecommunications. 2 of the contacts involve electrical services. 4 contacts involve natural gas. There were no contacts involving gas and electric services. There was 1 contact involving cellular service and no contacts involving the Do Not Call registry. 1,066 of the 1,306 complaints received in 2005 have been resolved, and 2,126 of the 2,371 contacts received in 2004 have been resolved.
Thank you, Sarah. Are there any questions? Next item is complaints. Item 1, CT05-001, in the matter of the complaint filed by WWC License LLC against Golden West Telecommunications Cooperative, Inc., Vivian Telephone Sioux Valley, Armor Independent, Bridgewater Canastota, Kadoka Telephone Company regarding intercarrier billings. This will be handled by Harlan.
Rich,
I didn't even see you sitting there.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, commissioners, and staff. My name is Richard Coit, and I am here today as the General Counsel and Executive Director of SDTA. Sitting here thinking, first thing I noticed is I left my notes at the office on my argument. Secondly, I'm thinking that my timing maybe on this intervention is maybe not the best. Given the commission's action last week on late filed interventions, I'm not feeling real confident about this, but I'm going to give it a shot anyway. First is, and I would, you know, this is a different proceeding than those proceedings where we normally notice an intervention. This is a complaint proceeding. And in a complaint proceeding, the commission doesn't normally notice any intervention period. And we have not, obviously, been an intervening party prior to this time in this case. There's a reason for that. Given the fact that there is no specifically noticed intervention period, I could at least make the argument that this is not late filed. With respect to our intervention, we're filing this intervention at this time in this process because of some things that Western Wireless has newly alleged in the case. The first would be some of these constitutional issues involving SDCL 4931-109 through 115. As you know, those statutes that were enacted a couple of years ago that deal with signaling requirements of originating carriers and transiting carriers, and also with respect to the studying of traffic to determine percentages of different types of traffic for purposes of rendering appropriate bills. Those statutes passed a couple of years ago are being challenged currently in the federal district court, and we are involved in that process. We are an intervening party in that process. We were granted intervention by the federal court. It's in the Central District for South Dakota. And complaint proceeding here did not initially involve the constitutionality of those statutes. Western Wireless, I think on August 10th, gave notice on or about that date that they were going to challenge in this process, in this complaint proceeding, the constitutionality of those statutes. They followed that up with an amended complaint filing to raise that constitutional issue in a little bit more detail, I guess, or a little more formal fashion. So they have now very clearly put forth in this process the constitutionality issues. I'm not sure if the commission is going to or has the ability to address those issues in this case, but certainly Western Wireless is trying to raise them. So that certainly piqued our interest in the case. Because we are a party in the federal court proceeding, we felt that if there are going to be any arguments surrounding constitutionality of those statutes in this proceeding, that we feel we have a right to provide input on those issues. In addition to that, as I've noticed in my intervention, or noted in my intervention, there's a couple of other issues that we have an interest in and that we feel are important to the membership as a whole. And these are two issues that were not raised in the initial complaint. I think just generally looking at the initial complaint, the issues surrounded, primarily the payment of retroactive compensation. And the two new issues that we're dealing with are this claim on the part of Western Wireless that with respect to inter-MTA traffic that is terminated by the ILEX, they are making the argument that the ILEX have no right, or it's a violation of law for them to charge intrastate access rates on any of those minutes. They are going apparently to the language in the contract. I'm not sure if they're relying on anything else, but they are making a claim that it is not appropriate or valid to assess any intrastate access rates on those minutes. That being the case, that issue is one that could affect all of the companies. As I noted in the intervention as well, the agreements that exist out there, the reciprocal transport and termination interconnection agreement that exists between Western Wireless and the companies that are respondents in this docket or defendants in this docket, the agreements they have with Western Wireless are no different than the agreements that the other ILEX that are members of SDTA have with Western Wireless. The only difference really in any of those contracts has to do with the rates, reciprocal transport and termination rates. There's language in that contract, as I've noted, that would clearly indicate to us that either interstate or intrastate access rates would apply depending on the nature of the inter-MTA traffic. So we disagree and we dispute those claims, and those are claims that definitely could affect any of the SDTA member companies that have contracts. So a resolution of that issue by this commission in this case will have a financial impact on the other SDTA member companies, depending on how it's resolved. The other issue that is an issue that doesn't affect all of the SDTA member companies, but certainly a few of them, there's a transiting issue with respect to the payment of compensation on minutes that are transited by Golden West. There are other SDTA member companies that provide a similar transit service, and what Western Wireless is claiming with respect to the transiting is that there's no existing agreement that they have with Western Wireless to cover those minutes, and therefore they're not liable for any compensation for any of those minutes. We disagree with that strongly on behalf of those other companies, on behalf of Golden West and the other companies that have that provide transiting services. The interesting thing to me is very clearly Western Wireless has requested those services. Those services are being delivered to Western Wireless. They're of value to Western Wireless. They cause an expense to the companies. We cannot agree with any position indicating that they have no responsibility to pay some compensation for those minutes. And that's another issue, therefore, that can affect some of the companies, some of the other companies. Kennebec provides some transiting services. The situations are different. I don't know at this particular period in time how many of those companies have agreements to cover the transiting minutes. I know that some don't, so they're similarly situated with Golden West. We can't support this claim that they don't owe anything for the minutes. A service is being provided, and there should be some just compensation for it. So those are the issues that we have an interest in. With respect to the intervention, we really just didn't see any option at this point. I mean, they've filed an amended complaint that raises issues that are important to the entire membership, and for that reason, we really feel we need to be involved. If the intervention is not acceptable, then I think there needs to be some consideration toward confining the issues in the case so none of the other SDTA member companies are prejudiced by any ultimate decision that the commission makes. And with that, I guess I would take any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Rich. Will you have anyone else making any presentations?
No.
All right. Any questions for Mr. Coit at this time?
I do have a comment, Mr. Chairman. I think you did a good job leaving your notes back at the office.
Well, thank you. Anything else?
I have a question, and I would agree you should leave your notes behind more often.
Well, that sounds good.
I'm reasonably sure I understand, but I just want to make sure my assumption's right. The impetus for your intervention filing are claims that were made in the September amended complaint and not the February original complaint.
That's right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You usually don't talk as long when you bring your notes. That's why we're
exactly. That's bad.
Thank you very much. Tal, are you still on the line with us?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have something you would like to address here?
Yes, I do. I do have my notes in front of me. So I'll try to follow his example and keep it short and brief. I think the first thing I want to clarify is the grounds of his intervention. This was filed as a refund case back 6-8 months ago. The answer asserted by the Golden West companies raised these statutes, and our answer to that counterclaim then raised the constitutionality or raised we didn't think these statutes apply. The problem we ran into on these statutes, and the only reason they appear in the amended complaint is if the commission recalls in August when we had the hearing about continuing it, we were ordered to raise all the issues we could, even the legal issues, and so out of, frankly, I didn't have to raise them in my amended complaint. I could have waited for the counterclaim and then raised them in my answer because the counterclaim brings up the statute, not actually the complaint. And I could have raised them in my answer. So this is not essentially When Golden West asserted their counterclaim, I was forced to raise the constitutionality as a legal defense to their counterclaim. Their counterclaim essentially asserts or implies that if we do not provide information that shows the origination of the call, which the CMRS carriers do not provide, they can treat every one of those calls as a local call. And number one, our defense has been, we don't think the interconnection agreement allows that. Number two, even if the interconnection, if we don't think constitutionally you can do that. So that's been our defense. No, so this is not something that we brought up as part of the complaint. It's something we've been forced into as part of a counterclaim. But I think to put it back on this is that all of a sudden we're trying to buy something in on an amended complaint late that's incorrect. It's been something that's been part of this litigation for a long time and became part of it because of the counterclaim, not the complaint. This is not a situation if you prevent intervention that these issues won't be fully addressed. The Golden West companies are certainly going to address and fully litigate these issues. I don't think SDTA's involvement does anything but potentially delay this case. We're already past discovery deadline. We served our last set of discovery last week with answers to be filed before this month is out. And there's no way I can serve discovery on Mr. Coy to get a determination whether SDTA's positions are going to be different from Golden West. There's no guarantee that Golden West and SDTA are going to approach this from the same theories or from the same positions of interpretations of the contract. So I think this late intervention is far too late as to be allowed in. Also, as Mr. Coyta mentioned, we noticed the challenge of these constitutionality of these matters way back in the 1st of August. It sounds as if he knew that this issue was out there somewhere before, and he certainly could have tried to jump in a month earlier when we were resetting discovery deadline after it was continued. As to his second issue on the transiting, I think he probably said it best there as not every one of his companies would be in the same position. Some might have agreements, some might not. So I think every company under SDTA is going to be determined by this commission as they come forward if there's an argument over transiting in the future with a different company. I think the evidence between whether there has been a request by Western or Golden West to do some transiting is specific evidence as to only this one act and these parties, and is likely there's going to be different factual scenarios with every company. So I don't see that issue on transiting, the binding impact, any decision on transiting has a binding impact on other members of SDTA. And with that, cut my notes short so I can open up for questions.
Thank you, Tal. Are there any questions by the commission? Then, Rolaine.
Staff does not object to granting the intervention, and that's just based on the fact that there was an amended complaint filed in September. There are issues that weren't in the original complaint, such as the transiting issue and the intra-MTA access rate issue that wasn't specifically spelled out in the original complaint. And those are issues that would directly affect SDTA members. So based on those reasons, staff would not object.
Thank you. John, did you have something?
I have a question, I guess, and it's really for all the attorneys, just with respect to the point that Mr. Wysorek made regarding the status of discovery and whether if the commission does grant intervention, if we can stay on course and meet the scheduled hearing deadline, which is November 7th.
It certainly wasn't my intention that, you know, by stepping in that I wanted that schedule altered. There's certainly some, I think, from our perspective, knowing it from Golden West perspective, there's a lot of motivation for the ILEX to get these issues resolved. So it wasn't our intention to delay the process at all. We ourselves do not have any intentions to conduct any discovery of Western Wireless. I'm not sure what their intentions would be.
I would just state if Mr. Resort needs to conduct discovery with SDTA, I would just suggest that his answers, Mr. Coit's answers, would be due at the same time as the outstanding discovery requests are due that were just filed last. That was filed last Friday. We just filed our discovery, and I believe that they're due October 26th, I think.
I've got my file here. I just didn't dig it out. Ms. Rafferty.
Good morning. My name is Darla Pullman-Rogers, and I would echo staff's position on this. We do not object to SDTA's intervention in this case.
Did you have anything to say in response to my question, Tal?
Well, I think I probably have to serve something on SBTA just to make a determination of whether their interpretation of the interconnection agreement is different to the Golden West Company. I simply can't wait for the hearing to have a different theory on what the interconnection agreement is supposed to say coming out of SBTA versus Golden West.
Well, let me ask, as a practical matter, if the commission were to grant intervention, is it practically doable for you to get whatever discovery you have served expeditiously on SDTA in order to stay on schedule? And Rich has stated here that he's not going to do any discovery.
I can certainly serve a set of it. I hope the commission understands that sometimes it's hard to answer that question without seeing how they might respond. If SDTA raises something that has not before been discussed or litigated in response to interrogatories, a whole different theory or a different way to look at this, it puts me in a position where answer actually might make it more difficult for the hearing. I think I can serve interrogatories, and if Mr. Coit certainly probably would have time to respond, actually, my biggest concern is how he responds. If all of a sudden I see something that is brand new to the whole litigation or procedure.
When is the deadline for response?
I do have down that actually it was due the 28th. I think so. It's rolling to the 26th, but on my calendar here, it shows it's the 28th.
Well, Mr. Coit, would you be willing to adhere to a more expedited response deadline than that due to the lateness of your intervention? And again, I'm assuming this is not going to be, Tal, a request for massive amounts of data, but more requesting their point of view on issues?
That would be correct, because my understanding would be SBTA wouldn't have any independent data anyway as to all data or study data.
I think as long as, you know, the questions are not directed towards recovering a lot of data from the member companies, I'd return the response as quickly as possible, which, you know, if there are questions regarding interpretation, I mean, it shouldn't take more than just a few days to get those back, and I would just commit to get those back as quickly as possible. And I can't see why I couldn't get that back to him before the 26th.
What if we were to say more like the 14th or 15th? And I'm not, I don't have a calendar in front of me, so I'm not quite sure what days those are. So that in case he has some follow-ups, that can still keep us on track.
Yeah, and I could also just talk to Mr. Wazorik after the meeting, and we could come to some agreement on some dates if those work. You know, if that works, otherwise I guess we'd be willing for to have staff direct us to the dates that if they can do that. I don't, you know, it might help for me to just kind of talk to Mr. Wazorik about it.
Thank you, John. Well, we'd like to take some action on this, obviously, today, October 20th. Sixth, or if it's expedited beyond that, it's going to be tomorrow. So I need to take some action on this, and I'm curious if there's any timeline that has to be worked out before we make a motion.
Well, I mean, that's
it's pretty, a Saturday.
Well, whatever, a date in that area. I think your suggestion, and again, I'm not presuming the commission's going to grant the intervention. What I want to know is, and let me ask you one more question. I mean, if it got down to the commission, would it not, because you're an intervener, if, I mean, I'm assuming Mr. Wieczorek's fearful of some radical new or fairly substantial new issues being interjected in this thing. I mean, I guess it would be my feeling that the commission would have authority to impose some limitations on that kind of thing happening if we get down to that.
I would say that that's not likely. I don't know what his question is.
Could you move to the mic, Rich, just so that others can hear?
Keep thinking I'm done, but I'm not. I would say that's not likely, and I am as long as you know we're not talking about a bunch of data from the member companies that I have to go out and collect, which always takes me a little bit of time. I could submit my answers by the 14th, if that's acceptable.
Thank you. Did you have anything else, sir?
No, I don't.
I will. Did you have a question? Commissioner Johnson, did you have a question?
No, sir.
I will make a motion then that the commission grant intervention to the South Dakota Telecommunications Association, and the date that we were discussing will be October 14th.
Second.
I concur.
Under electric. First item is EL04-016 in the matter of the filing by Superior Renewable Energy, LLC, against Montana Dakota Utilities regarding the Java Wind Project. The question before the commission is, today shall the commission grant the deferral motion? Two, shall the commission issue an order finding that MDU has an existing obligation and or contract pending? And three, shall a commission issue an order to show cause to MDU? I believe MDU has a motion for deferral before us.
So. Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Dave Gertis. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Montana Dakota in this proceeding. I do have my notes with me, but I thought I had left them at the office. But I found them in this pile of stuff that's in front of me. The first thing I'd like to say, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, because this is a very high-interest topic in this state and in the Plains states generally, I want it to be clearly understood that Montana, Dakota is not against wind power, is not against non-renewables, is not against any other type of energy. MDU believes that it has a responsibility to its ratepayers and to its stockholders to evaluate all offers in the marketplace. This is but one of several approaches of this kind that MDU has received, and MDU believes that it needs to evaluate all such applications. And so I want that on the table just so that it's understood that it has nothing to do with the fact that MDU does not intend to be involved in wind power. Secondly, there has been some discussion in the filings by Superior that MDU somehow should be penalized for having delayed the process. As we've discussed in our filing, and we did file responsive comments yesterday, we believe that's totally irrelevant. We believe there's plenty of blame to go around if you want to talk about that, but whether or not there was a delay, we believe is relevant, irrelevant. On the merits of whether or not a deferral should occur in this case, Montana Dakota believes, quite frankly, that the core issue here is if for the convenience of the parties and for the as a method of saving both work and costs on the part of the parties, does it make sense to delay this process until FERC has decided, which it will decide very shortly after the time that the hearing in this matter is now scheduled? So do we want to go ahead and have an avoided cost hearing on something that has been already negotiated between the parties, or do we want to see what FERC has to say about whether or not the Energy Policy Act has sort of changed the rules in the middle of the game? And we would submit that it is a small delay when we think about what could happen if we go ahead with the current, if we go ahead with the current plan, the current schedule. I would like to make a comment about the issues that are before the commission. It's our view that the issue before the commission is a deferral motion. Now, I know that the agenda states and that staff has stated that the issue before the commission also involves whether or not there's an obligation on the part of MDU to purchase energy under the Federal Energy Act. We would submit that the only thing before the commission is the motion to defer. And there are other grounds to support the motion to defer other than whether or not an obligation to an obligation exists. And so thus, while there is consideration of whether or not there is an obligation, that's part of the analytical process that the commission is going to go through. Nonetheless, the actual question before the commission is simply whether or not it will defer. And I think it's important to keep that in mind, because otherwise we would submit that the commission perhaps maybe is straying beyond its statutory jurisdiction. We also would suggest that perhaps the commission would be setting a precedent that it may not want to set. And so for those reasons, we think that the question before the commission is whether or not there should be a deferral. The other thing the commission should consider, because this very same question is before FERC in at least two contexts, the Alliant petition and the MDU petition. And so what happens if the commission makes a finding on the question of obligation and FERC goes ahead and makes a different finding, its decision? Then we have, as my grandmother used to say, a fine kettle of fish. And so it seems to us that the most logical thing to do is to simply defer and wait and see what FERC does. And that's why we made the motion. As I've said, I think that the question of whether or not an obligation exists really is a subsidiary question and needs to be answered by this commission, not definitively, but only as to whether or not there's a reasonable basis to believe that an obligation does in fact exist. And on that basis, we believe that there is no contract or obligation in effect and pending before the commission. And we would disagree with staff's position in their filing that an obligation exists, because if Congress had intended that the savings clause apply to every QF certified before passage of the Act, it could have easily have said as much. But it did not say that. The fact that the Act refers to a contract or obligation in effect or pending approval clearly means more than a simple demand to purchase by a non-existent QF. In other words, what are the price, quality, term, and delivery conditions? None of that part of the obligation is defined. If an obligation is in effect, it must be reciprocal. What are superiors' responsibilities under this obligation? Because there have to be reciprocal obligations. Again, we don't know what those are. So why do we, if this was an obligation, why do we need to have a hearing to determine what the terms of the obligation are? By very definition, the obligation is an obligation, and it should be clearly defined. So it's our belief that as it relates to the amendment to PURPA, we believe that Congress did not intend that the mere fact that a QF has qualified gives rise to an obligation. I mean, current law is that the obligation is only conditional upon the parties being able to negotiate a satisfactory contract. I mean, the obligation is not unconditional, and so thus we submit that it's not an obligation at all. The other point I would like to raise, Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission, and this, of course, is perhaps treading on somewhat thin ground, because I now want to tell the Commission it doesn't have the authority to do what Superior has asked. We did discuss that in our filing with the Commission. If you look at the South Dakota Supreme Court's decision of the petition of Northwestern Public Service Company decided in 1997, the South Dakota Supreme Court unequivocally said, number one, the PUC is not a court and cannot exercise purely judicial functions. The other thing the court said very clearly is that there has to be some statutory authority to support the commission's ability to render the relief that it is seeking to render. And again, we would submit that if you look at the chapter of the code that we are working under here, there simply is no authority for this commission to make decisions under PURPA. And it has, and the legislature has not given this commission the ability to do so. Contrast that with telecommunications. If you look at 493181, the legislature has clearly said that the commission may implement and comply with the provisions of the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996. But I would submit that the commission does not have that same kind of broad grant of authority to implement PURPA. And so therefore, and we submit that this question, whether or not there's an obligation, is in fact a federal question, and it is in fact in front of FERC, and it should be decided by FERC. Finally, I like to just very briefly touch the Iowa decision that that was submitted by Superior. They submitted saying that they think the commission should consider this as in reaching its decision. There are numerous things that distinguish the Iowa decision from the questions that the commission has before it. First of all, in the Iowa decision, it involved a statutory stay procedure that is not applicable here. There were issues concerning whether or not a deadline would be missed in order for the applicant to receive a state tax incentive. Those issues are not present here, and to our knowledge, there really isn't any reason why, under South Dakota law, this matter could not be continued if the commission so ordered. The Iowa decision also was based upon the fact that at least one of the dockets before the Iowa commission had been fully briefed and was had been fully donut time. It just happens to me. I was reaching for my phone, as a matter of fact, when I heard it. The other reason is that one of those dockets was ready for decision, and the Iowa board said in the case of the other three, in 90 days, that not that much is going to happen in the other three dockets anyway. So they were saying no harm, no foul. We don't need to postpone. So we would submit that the Iowa decision is clearly distinguishable. We would submit that this commission is treading, we submit, on thin ground in making a clearly federal decision based upon the statutory authority that this commission has to act. There are other grounds not involving the FERPA amendments that exist and other reasons that this commission should delay the hearing date from its current early November date to see what FERC does in these matters. And again, I would just reiterate the issue of whether or not an obligation exists is in front of FERC in both of the petitions, the Alliant petition and the MDU petition. So if you want to talk about preemption, we can talk about that too. Has the federal act preempted this commission's ability to address that issue? Certainly it's before FERC now, before anyone else. And with that, we would ask that the commission grant the motion to defer.
Thank you, Dave. In your remarks towards the beginning, and I was trying to follow the I just have a quick question. You stated that the only issue before us was that MDU had filed a deferral motion requesting the continuance, and that we didn't have the other item before us. Notwithstanding your remarks arguing against that particular position, Superior did file a response to your deferral motion and requested that the commission deny your deferral motion and to grant affirmative relief in the form of an order finding that MDU has an existing obligation and or contract pending. So would that not place that item before us?
Well, I guess the way I read the Superior filing, it was more in the nature of a, quote, request than in the nature of a, quote, motion. And it's my experience anyway that motion practice involves a specifically defined issue that is placed before the commission. And I was reading the Superior filing as being less than that. Obviously, the commission needs to address it as the commission views it. But it says it's a request for affirmative relief. Well, we make motions around here, and I didn't read it that way.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Mr. Gertis, do you know, has this commission handled issues involving avoided costs in the past, to your knowledge? Or any other proper interpretation or delegation?
Well, of course, avoided costs, yes, I believe this commission has handled avoided cost questions, but it's my... That is something that is delegated to the states by PURPA, and it's something that nobody's objected to. If you're addressing my point about there being a statutory impediment to the commission going to the question of an obligation, nobody's objected to it.
Well, but I did think it was an interesting point, and I was kind of curious to flesh it out a little bit more. I may have some questions for you after we hear from the other parties, so thank you.
Yeah, and I'll be happy to answer. But I think, here, if you look at the Northwestern Public Service petition, I think it's the same thing. I think the commission had interpreted contracts similar to the one that was involved in Northwestern Public Service before, but nobody objected.
Okay, so your distinction would be in cases where perhaps we did handle something that was delegated under PURPA or similar federal electricity laws, that in those cases, to your knowledge, nobody objected to jurisdiction.
Excuse me. That would be my understanding, yes.
Thank you.
Further questions? John?
Would you address the Metropolitan Edison cases from FERC back in 1995 that were cited by Superior and their relation to the issue of whether this commission has authority to make this decision?
Well, I believe the answer is that my objection is under state law or a lack of statutory authority for the commission to act.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm just going to note one thing, it's very, very minor, but if people on the line or in the room do what I do and follow along through the live links or the links on our website, it's very, very minor, but under electric, the agenda item number one, the docket is should be EL04016, and it's EL05016. But I checked the link, and again, it's wonderful to have this, so I'm not criticizing. I just want to let people know, though, if you click on the link, and it's right in the printed agenda, but if you click on the link, you will get to the right docket. For those of you who on the line or in the room, bounce back and forth like I do and check it out versus carrying the files up. It is correct when you actually click on the link.
Thank you. We'll hear from the Superior attorneys, Brad or Linda.
Hi. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. This is Brad Moody in Houston, Texas, for Superior Renewable Energy. And with us on the telephone is my co-counsel, Linda Walsh, in Washington, D.C. I want to speak initially to some of the comments made by Mr. Gerdes on behalf of MDU, and also in general address this question of whether or not the commission should grant the motion to defer. And then I want to turn the floor, so to speak, over to Ms. Walsh to discuss some of the particulars of the petitions that have been filed by MDU and Alliance and how those petitions may impact the motion and the request that Superior has made for a finding that there is an obligation in effect that is protected even under the recent amendments to FERPA. When Mr. Gerdes was speaking at the beginning of his remarks, he said that it was totally irrelevant how much delay MDU has caused by its failure to negotiate. And this comment mirrors the pleading that MDU filed yesterday afternoon. I want to read the first sentence of the first paragraph of that pleading, because I think it's really important in terms of illuminating exactly what's been going on over the course of the last 2 years. That sentence says, while Superior spends a great deal of time arguing that Montana Dakota intentionally delayed the proceeding and failed to negotiate in good faith, even if it were true, it has no bearing on the questions before the commission. In plain terms, what that sentence says to me is that MDU is asking this commission to ignore the fact that for almost 3 years, Superior has been trying to obtain a power purchase agreement with MDU under the FERPA statute. That during that time, MDU has been unwilling to negotiate with Superior, that MDU has failed to provide the required avoided cost information necessary to complete that agreement, that MDU has misrepresented its avoided cost to this commission and to Superior during the course of the proceeding. And in effect, what they're saying is, ignore all of this obfuscation and ignore this delay, because if you let me keep bootstrapping my delay long enough, maybe Superior will get tired or run out of money and go away. Well, Superior believes that the law says you've got to take all of that prior conduct into account when deciding whether or not to grant this motion. And I'm here to tell you that Superior has absolutely no intention of going away. Superior is ready, willing, and able to operate the Java Wind project. The only problem with this project has been getting MTU to comply with its obligations under the FERPA statute. We filed an affidavit from Superior's executive Jeff Ferguson, documenting that Superior has spent almost $600,000 so far to develop this Java Wind project. Superior has acquired wind easements, measured wind data, conducted engineering studies, and paid interconnection fees to MISO, and certainly has incurred substantial legal expense going before this commission to try and bring MDU to the table and do what it's required to do under the FERPA statute. Everything about the Java Wind project looks great, except for the fact that MDU will not do what it's supposed to do under FERPA and negotiate in good faith for a PPA. Now, Superior didn't spend $600,000 on the Java Wind project because it had some vain hope that someday MDU might decide that wind power was a good thing and that it to sit down and negotiate at arm's length for a power purchase agreement. Superior invested that money in the project because at the time it began the activity, the FERPA statute gave Superior, as a qualified facility, the absolute right to sell energy and capacity to MDU at MDU's avoided cost. As my co-counsel, Ms. Walsh, will explain in greater detail, that obligation has existed since 2003, when Superior filed as a qualified facility and first asked MDU to provide Superior with the avoided cost information so that the PPA negotiations could go forward. Those kind of pre-existing obligations are protected from the limited exemption that MDU is using as a basis for its deferral motion. So as we sit here today, MDU's obligation to take power from the Java Wind facility still exists. PURPA is still the law, and the Commission's decision and order implementing PURPA is still in effect. MDU has not been granted an exemption by this Commission or by the FERC, and it continues to be obligated to negotiate in good faith with Superior for a long-term power purchase agreement. Now, is MDU negotiating in good faith? Well, right now, MDU isn't talking to Superior at all. It has simply cut off negotiations and come to the Commission and said, we need more time to resolve these complicated issues and appeals and whatnot. May take who knows how long, but that's what we want. Now, if you knew that there was a pending amendment to the PURPA statute in the Energy Policy Act of 2005, would it be good faith not to disclose your intention to invoke that amendment as a basis to halt negotiations? I think it sounds like MDU was negotiating during this March to September time period with its fingers crossed behind its back. So, in any event, we've got significant delay. What are the consequences of this delay? In the last year, the price of steel, turbines, concrete, and other construction costs have risen substantially. Besides adversely affecting the economics of the Java Wind project, these costs are affecting MDU's avoided costs as well. They're causing them to go up, and that's a problem for MDU, and it's a problem for MDU's ratepayers to the extent that MDU is going to be asking this commission to pass those costs through. The longer we delay this proceeding, the worse that problem is going to become. Superior believes that PURPA, even the recent amendments to PURPA, do not allow this delay to take place. Take a look at the recent Iowa Utilities Board decision, which ruled that no delay should be forthcoming in a very similar situation. In that decision, the board adopted a four-part test applicable to stays and said that based on all four of those portions of the test, the proceedings should be allowed to go forward. The four parts of the test are whether there would be irreparable harm to MDU if the stay is denied, whether there's any harm to any party from granting a stay, how the public interest will be affected by granting or not granting a stay, and the probability that MDU will prevail at the FERC. We think this is a good decision, and we think the Commission should follow it. MDU has shown no evidence of irreparable harm. As the Iowa Utilities Board held, the time and the resources of the parties to conduct this hearing is not irreparable harm. On the other side of the coin, there will be harm to Superior if this matter is further delayed. There's an expiring federal production tax credit and an interconnection agreement with MISO that has a similar time fuse attached to it. If either of these events expire, then the Java Wind project could be in danger. Now, with respect to the public interest, Superior believes that the Commission has recognized repeatedly the importance of wind power to the state of South Dakota. The Commission knows that South Dakota possesses tremendous wind resources and that the development of these resources will add jobs, property taxes, and an essential commodity to future growth in the state. These all dictate to me that the public interest is supported by allowing this hearing to go forward. Last but certainly not least, Superior believes that MDU faces a low probability of success in obtaining the relief that it's requested from the FERC. To address the details of that, I think Ms. Walsh would like to have a few minutes to talk to you about the Alliant and MDU petition. Thank you.
One moment, please. Brad, thank you very much. We have a court reporter, and I'm always amazed at how she's able to keep up with all of the the speed at which people talk. We're off the record for a moment. How are we doing? You okay? All right.
Mr. Chairman?
We're back on the record. Questions?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for Mr. Moody. Actually, a couple of them, and they don't involve the Alliant Fowling or the other one that he said his co-counsel is going to discuss. So if it'd be appropriate, could I ask, was it now,
Go
Mr.
ahead.
Chairman, please? Thank you. Mr. Moody, a couple of questions. First is, under PURPA, if a state does lack jurisdiction, then who would decide the questions that are at issue here?
Well, again, the Metropolitan Edison case that Superior cites in its brief says that the Congress and the FERC have ultimately delegated to the State Public Utility Commission the authority for deciding the type of question that underlies the MDU motion to defer, namely whether there's an existing obligation or contract.
And
if for whatever reason the FERC changed its mind and said, no, in fact, the states haven't been delegated that responsibility, I suppose it would be with the FERC.
Well, I know in telecommunications law, oftentimes if a state either does not have authority to act or chooses not to act on a certain issue, which they sometimes can, then it gets bumped up to the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. And I was just curious if you knew whether or not that was the case with issues like this, if Mr. Gerdes is able to successfully raise the point on jurisdiction.
All I can say is that the FERC historically appears to have exercised sort of high-level authority to watch over state implementation of the PURPA statute. But when parties who don't like what's happening in the state public utility commissions have come to FERC for relief, very often FERC has said, no, we delegated this authority to the state PUCs for a reason. Now go back and get your issues resolved there.
And then, you know, I certainly appreciate your perspective on the importance of wind power and the Java wind farm and so on and so forth. But one of the things I didn't hear you address is Mr. Gerdes's claim that we lack statutory authority to decide these issues. And to me, that is a very important issue, because if we don't have the authority, regardless of how important it might be to the state, regardless of what's happened in the course of negotiations, we would be unable to legally act if that argument does prevail. Do you have any perspective on whether or not you think this commission has authority either under state or under some sort of federal catch-all?
Sure. And I'll tell you briefly, because we, again, only had the benefit of seeing this argument at 4:15 yesterday afternoon, but I would tell you that ever since the initial decision and order implementing the PURPA statute, this commission has certainly acted as if it has had the authority to resolve issues under the PURPA statute. And I'd go further and say that MDU has acknowledged that as well, by continually making the required filings under the PURPA statute for small generators. There is a tariff in effect right now approved by the commission for the small generator PURPA tariff. So if there's a problem with jurisdiction, it's never been raised in the many, many years that the statute has been in effect.
So what – just to understand the last point, so would it be your contention then that because there is a tariff filing that somehow possibly brings MDU under state jurisdiction?
No, I'm not arguing that. I think what I'm trying to say is that we certainly haven't seen any behavior by either the commission or MDU to this point to suggest that there's any jurisdictional problem with respect to MDU's with respect to the delegation by the FERC to the commission to implement PURPA. We've had these tariff filings made consistently for many, many years without ever anybody, MDU in particular, saying that somehow under state law the commission doesn't have the authority to review and accept these tariffs for filing. And certainly in the original decision and order implementing FERPA, the commission didn't question its own jurisdiction.
Well, I appreciate kind of that historical and maybe practical perspective, but thinking back to my days in law school and private practice and government practice and here on the commission, I mean, jurisdiction either exists or it doesn't exist, and I don't know if past practice, I don't know of any cases that are going to hold the past practice necessarily confers jurisdiction that does not otherwise preside with the tribunal. And that's where if you could, I mean, if you can elaborate on and I realize you're late in the game and maybe need some more time, just say so. But here we have a party in, you know, albeit several months into the docket, has made the contention that we don't have jurisdiction. If we don't have it, I don't know how we can proceed. I mean, I think it is an important issue for you to address, you know, beyond all the, you know, the arguments that you're making about, you know, general fairness and past practice. I think we do need to hit that question or address the question of whether or not we have jurisdiction, because frankly, in my mind, while certainly compelling to some extent, I don't know if it carries much legal weight to say past practices was this and looking at the course of negotiations and so on and so forth if we don't have the jurisdiction in the first place.
Well, I don't have much to add to the argument at this point, and certainly if this is of great concern to the commission, Superior needs to go back and look at the site that appears in MDU's brief on this question. It is surprising that, in the almost 2 years that we've been in front of the commission, we're suddenly hearing that there's a problem. Usually these kind of jurisdictional issues are raised initially because people, see the problem and bring it to the commission's attention. So with that, I guess I'd say let us go back and study on this and, if necessary, submit supplemental brief.
Well, and I'll also look to PUC staff on that issue and see what their perspective is, and they may be able to answer the question that I'm asking. So I appreciate you taking these questions now, and perhaps the other parties may be able to help flesh out some of those details. I just didn't want to lose my train of thought on the jurisdiction issue, so thank you.
Certainly.
Any further questions? If not, we will hear from Linda Walsh.
Hi, thank you, Commissioners, for having this discussion. I'd like to add something on the jurisdictional issue, if I may. FERC delegated to the states the duty to implement PURPA and gave states options on how to do that. And the South Dakota Commission issued its order, F3365, I believe it's the number. And the state opted to require tariffs for small QFs, less than 100 kW, and required that larger QFs negotiate with the utility, and that the commission would then step in if necessary if negotiations fail. That's just one of the options. States also had the option to actually implement procedures for larger facilities, and it necessarily varies from state to state as a result. Now, I think the question on jurisdiction is if the states have the authority to implement PURPA and gave them lots of discretion on how to do that, then, certainly part of that discretion is to determine whether or not a particular QF was properly before the commission in the first place. And I think that's where the state gets the authority and certainly has the jurisdiction to consider this proceeding and the particular issue of whether there's an existing obligation. To say otherwise would essentially say that FERC didn't have the authority to delegate all of the PURPA implementation procedures in the first place, which, that's been in effect for several decades now. So I'm not sure that we need to go that far into the question. I'd like to also
speak to the particular, the FERC cases in this proceeding. We have an alliance petition that was filed in August, and we have a MDU petition that was filed just about 2 weeks ago. And I noticed in the Superior's response, we put that the a decision in the alliance proceeding was expected in early December. It's really in November that it's expected. So there was an error there. I think I just calculated the dates wrong. And that corresponds to the 90 days that's in the Energy Act of 2005, and that requires FERC it render its decision within 90 days of a petition filed. Now, the Act specifically states that FERC is to determine whether or not a service territory of the applicant, in this case, Alliant or MDU, has met the competitive, I'll call them the competitive test. There are those three requirements to indicate whether or not there is access to markets, essentially. The Act does not specifically state that FERC should consider whether there's an existing obligation on any particular, with respect to any particular QF. And that makes a lot of sense because the particular implementation was then turned over to the state. So FERC really never gets into questions regarding particular QF in this kind of a situation because it has turned that over to the state. I agree that the issue on whether there is an existing obligation with respect to the Alliant petition and the MDU petition is, in fact, before FERC because the applicants have raised that issue. So, while it's certainly possible that FERC will rule on those questions, it doesn't have to rule on those questions in 90 days and doesn't have to rule on the question at all. It could just pass on that question. It doesn't have to rule. It just has to rule on those competitive questions, which is part of a 210M1, the three factors, which are cited in all the pleadings here. So, while there's a decision in 90 days expected on the Alliant petition and then 90 days from the MDU petition, which the MDU petition would put us into December, there's no telling whether or not those decisions from FERC are actually going to make any difference in this proceeding. There's no question. There's no telling whether they're going to decide the existing obligation question. FERC's precedent is that it turns that particular decision over to the states, which is the Metropolitan Edison case. And my sense is that they're going to do the same thing because there's no way they can make a generic rule on what an existing obligation is because it's necessarily very state-specific depending on how each state implemented PURPA. So my guess is they're going to say that particular question with respect to any particular facilities is for the state to decide. And the energy bill itself says that FERC is to make a service territory-wide determination, not a project-by-project determination on the question. So Mr. Gerda said earlier that there'd be a small delay if we wait for FERC to issue its decision. I don't think it'll be a small delay. It has the potential to be a very long delay. First, if FERC doesn't decide all of the issues, and also, there could be appeals of FERC's decision. That could extend things out who knows how long. There's no reason to delay the hearing when, FERC may not give any clear guidance on the particular issues here. I think also that one of the questions that Mr. Gerdes had answered about whether it's necessary to decide the question about whether there's an existing obligation in this case, and I think it is necessary for the commission to make that determination. It's certainly necessary for purposes of determining the whether to grant the motion to defer, because by definition the statute says it removes mandatory purchase obligations for obligations that are not existing. I think we have existing obligation here. We need to get that established and move forward
And because it's an existing obligation, there's really no need to defer the hearing. There's the only way you would need to defer the hearing is if there's a question on that. So I think that it's necessary to determine that definitively. I think it will also help FERC in the sense that FERC can take guidance from the state on the very question that FERC has before it. And that will help resolve that piece of the puzzle at FERC, which really belongs to the state in the first place. And I think that's all that I wanted to add. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Are there any questions by the commission? John?
Either Mr. Moody or Ms. Walsh, you know, we just looked at the affidavit of Mr. Ferguson that you filed yesterday that lists all those costs. Do you have concerns that if we forge ahead here and go to hearing, I mean, that's gonna be another lump of cost for you guys? And is that of concern to you that you do that and then things turn around and go the other way? I mean, I'm assuming by making your motion, you're willing to, or by resisting MDU's motion, you're willing to undertake that risk.
Mr. Smith, this is Mr. Moody. This is Brad Moody. I'll take a stab at answering that. The answer is yes. We think that going forward is the right answer and maybe even the most cost-effective answer, because in Superior's experience, a piecemeal resolution of all of the issues very often caused the ultimate cost to go up. So it's Superior's preference to go ahead and have the hearing, get all of these issues decided, and MDU will presumably appeal, and it'll all be decided at once.
Mr. Gerdes, did you have something to add to that?
Mr. Chairman, well, I do have some response to the argument of counsel. I don't have anything to add to the specific point raised by Mr. Smith.
All right. I'm debating whether to have you folks going back and forth or whether we should allow staff to jump into it at this point. Karen.
Well, this is Karen Kramer from staff. You can read staff's response, and we do believe that an obligation exists. I will just quickly address some of the points they've made, because I do know time is a factor here. I would agree with Ms. Walsh on her take on what the FERC Act or the PURPA Act in 1978 did. I don't have mine in front of me, the commission's order 3365, but my memory of that would coincide with her. And as to the Hub City case, if I remember that one correctly also, the court there did recognize and acknowledge that agencies have implied authority. As I remember that case, and so I think the commission does have jurisdiction here. We certainly acted as requested under the PURPA of 1978 with the order, and that FERC clearly anticipated state commissions have some active role in these matters. So I do believe we do have jurisdiction. My staff's concern with deferring this motion is the appeal process. You know, if it were to go to FERC and FERC were to make a decision in November, December, whatever it would be, that may be the most effective way and cost effective. But my concern becomes when everybody starts appealing, then you're talking a year and a half down the road, and we're still sitting here waiting to hear this matter. Sometimes it's best to just do it and be done with it. And that's staff's position. As to the cost to steal, that's really nothing. I think that's in front of the commission today. That's factual matter. That's nothing that we can decide. I've got notes all over, but if you have a particular question, I would take that.
I would like you to address the semantics of request versus motion.
I don't see one. I would agree with Mr. Gerdes in a courtroom situation that there is a difference, probably, but we don't we're not very formal here in by choice in administrative law, and I believe that that's what he's more accustomed to is the courtroom law where motions are made more formally. Here it's just real informal. And so I know what you were saying, but I didn't buy it.
Thank you. Mr. Gerdes, I'd like to give you an opportunity to respond to the staff's presentation and some of the discussion that took place with MDU.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate this
Is
opportunity,
your mic on?
And I will try to keep it full. I'm not sitting close enough to it. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, and I will try to keep this brief. I do have copies of the Northwestern Public Service Company decision with me, taking up one of the last items first, and I'd be happy to pass them out to staff and the commission. And I won't belabor the point, but if you go to the very last paragraph in the decision, the court says the PUC is not a court and cannot exercise purely judicial functions. And then going down in that same paragraph, it said the PUC has exceeded its statutory authority by interpreting and enforcing the contract between a rural cooperative and its customer. Now, that was the holding. So I will stand by the characterization of that decision as I made to the commission. Secondly, I think with respect to Commissioner Saar's question as to whether or not the question reverts back to FERC, I believe that in the amendment to PURPA, Congress has already given us that answer. If we look at subparagraph M, which is added to section 210 of PURPA, subparagraph 3, entitled Commission Review, the first sentence says, any electric utility may file an application with the commission for relief from the mandatory purchase obligation pursuant to this section on a service territory-wide basis. That's just what we've done. And it talks about relief from the mandatory purchase option. Now, we have just got done talking about that, and it would be my position that FERC, in fact, does have the jurisdiction to make that same decision, and it's now in front of them.
Is, Mr. Chairman, if I may, Mr. Gerdes, is that under the new provisions of
yes.
the Energy Act? Because I one of the things, of course, that we're grappling with is do we follow the old provisions or do we follow the new provisions? And I think there's some pretty good arguments both ways on that. Do you know, was there a similar, I don't want to call it backstop, but I guess it kind of is, was there a similar procedure, do you know, under the previous provisions or maybe at this point in time, maybe that's not even relevant. Probably in your mind, you like the new provisions.
Well,
so you can say that's not relevant, right?
Commissioner, in my mind, I like the new one, and I cannot answer your question as to what existed previously. It's been my general experience that I think it bounces back to the federal agency. I mean, if you talk about preemption as a concept, of course, it falls on the federal agency. But I beyond that, I can't comment. I really don't want to get into this argument about who, you know, he said, she said, who delayed what. If you look at our comments, however, Mr. Moody talked about, you know, MDAU isn't talking to Superior. Well, our comments talk about a point in time when Superior wasn't talking to MDU. So, you know, and without going into that any further, I'll just leave it at that. Mr. Moody, I think, made a mistake in his comments. He talked about Superior being a QF since 2003. I think the record will show that the QF filing was on April 15th of 2004. And then as far as the questions, the Iowa decision, Mr. Moody said that Iowa adopted a four-part test. Well, if you read the decision, it was a statutory four-part test that exists in Iowa, which does not exist here, and it doesn't apply to this proceeding, I would submit. And then, finally, the question of jurisdiction, and I think Commissioner Sauer pointed it out, but and that is jurisdiction is never waived. If a lack of jurisdiction exists, it can be brought up at any time, and the fact that MDU has participated in this proceeding does not prejudice its right to assert a lack of jurisdiction. Quite frankly, I think that probably the question can be divided. I view it that even though we go along in an avoided costs proceeding, when we start talking about the federal question of whether or not an obligation exists under the new PURPA language, then that can really be a different question, I believe. So those would be my comments. I don't want to drag this out too long.
Thank you. Did you have additional?
I have a question. I think Mr. Smith was in the queue first.
This one is, I think, for probably Ms. Walsh and maybe you too, Mr. Gerdes. Under the is not the way it worked under the old PURPA, and I think still works, with when viewed from the QF's point of view. The statute you're referring to, Dave, is a statute that gives the requested utility those rights.
That's correct.
But with respect to who oversees an avoided cost proceeding and the other proceedings relative to overseeing the PPA process, right? I mean, PURPA clearly indicated that with respect to regulated utilities, that would be state commissions.
Is that correct? That's true. But again, the fact that PURPA can delegate all it wants, but the only way this commission can respond to a delegation of authority is pursuant to statutory authority given by the legislature to this commission to respond.
Right. Here's my question. And Ms. Walsh, I'd like your response too. Let's assume then that if we were assuming, certainly without deciding, that we find we don't have jurisdiction to do anything here. And I think we either have jurisdiction to do most of it or none. Does that then mean that MDU under the terms of the PURPA law, and I don't have it here with me, I'm sorry, becomes an unregulated utility under the terms of the PURPA Act and therefore subject to the regulatory provisions under that act for unregulated utilities, which generally means co-ops, et cetera. But if none of our utilities are regulated at that point, is that the set of procedures that would obtain and would put this back in the hands of FERC to arbitrate or to adjudicate unreasonable actions by you?
I don't believe so, Mr. Smith, because, I mean, Montana, Dakota is a regulated utility under state law, certainly. And so I don't know how that changes that fact. I do not know under PURPA whether it is viewed by PURPA as being regulated or not. It's my impression that it is, but I haven't looked at that for a long time, so I can't answer
that. Well, I mean, the answer to that would be then no one would have authority to deal with this issue, literally.
Well,
there would be no agency out there capable of hearing the avoided cost proceeding in this case.
No, I'm saying that I think Montana Dakota is a regulated utility, both for PERCs, both for FERC's purposes and for the state's purposes, is what I'm saying.
And does that extend to this commission's authority to determine avoided cost and the other terms and conditions as originally envisioned by the PURPA Act?
You know, I haven't really analyzed that. I've always had the impression that the commission could do it because no one objected to it. But, I mean, I haven't done the extent of research that I would know. The research I did related to the question on whether an obligation exists or not. I can't answer your question completely at this point.
Do you have anything to add on that, Ms. Walsh?
Yes, I do, actually. I think the question of how the commission exercises jurisdiction depends on the issue. And bringing in that Northwest Public Service case, that case was a question of contract interpretation. And I think what we're talking about here is not a particular contract term that we're interpreting. We're interpreting a regulatory obligation, which
is squarely within the commission's jurisdiction. And, you know, even FERC will not generally get in the middle of a contract dispute between two parties, which is where I think the Northwest case was, what the issue that the Northwest case was dealing with. FERC will tell the parties to go to a state court to interpret a contract provision. For example, you know, who has to deliver at what time or how much, or, you know, who has the liability, or those kinds of issues are contract issues, and those FERC won't decide. If it has to do with rates, if it has to do with any terms and conditions of service that are jurisdictional, those are things that FERC will hear under its jurisdiction. And I think the same is true with the state. And if we're dealing with the regulatory question and things that are regulated by the state, which would include the PURPA obligation, the state certainly has jurisdiction. Now, if we were before the commission asking you to decide what a particular contract provision means or what the parties intended by that, that would be another question. And I think that would be the situation where the state probably shouldn't exercise jurisdiction. The question of what existed previously under PURPA, and PURPA 210 of PURPA went A through L, essentially, and the Energy Act of 2005 added section M, and M has many different subsections, and one of which allows utilities to apply to FERC for relief from the mandatory purchase obligation. And the Section M also contains provisions explaining how the utility should go about doing that. It also, though, contains a provision, and this is 210M6, which says that nothing in 210M is intended to, and I'll read the language specifically. It's entitled No Effect on Existing Rights and Remedies. Nothing in this subsection, which is referring to subsection M, affects the rights or remedies of any party under any contract or obligation in effect or pending approval before the appropriate state authority or non-regulated electric utility on the date of enactment of this subsection. And it continues on, but I think that's the relevant piece of it. And that's, I think, where we are now. The question is whether 210M applies at all in this case, which we think it doesn't, because this only affects new obligations. In fact, in the very beginning, 210M1 states that after the date of enactment of this subsection, no electric utility shall be required to enter into a new contract or obligation to purchase from a qualifying facility. And then it continues on if there are competitive markets. So I don't think that 210M applies at all and that the old rules are in effect, which has the mandatory obligation, purchase obligation in it.
Let me clarify just a little bit. What I'm getting at, and maybe I just don't have the act right in front of me. If we have no authority under PURPA to do anything because we're lacking an explicit legislative delegation here at the state level, then does MDU become an unregulated utility and subject to the unregulated utility provisions under the original PURPA Act?
Well, if I understand correctly, if what you're saying is that the state did not have the authority to accept the delegation from FERC in the first place?
That's right. That's right. And again, that's not quite the Hub City case, but what I'm getting at is, to the extent that we don't have the authority to regulate, does that render MDU an unregulated utility under PURPA and therefore subject to those provisions, that particular regulatory regime that applies to unregulated utilities like co-ops?
Well, I guess I can't answer that question. Unregulated utilities are certainly covered by PURPA, and I think it's essentially the same obligation. It's just not enforceable by a PUC. But FERC has a enforcement authority. So if an unregulated utility were to fail to comply with PURPA, parties can go to FERC and seek enforcement. FERC has rarely done that. We did cite one case, one recent case, is the Swecker case, where FERC did, in fact, exercise enforcement authority, and that was against an unregulated utility.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have one more question
right,
for
please,
Mr. Harris, if I could, please. Dave, when we talk about jurisdiction here, and I'm trying not to lose – I want to make sure I understand your argument. Is your argument that that we possibly lack jurisdiction for anything before us before all matters of within this docket and not just some aspects of it, and we could pursue other aspects with jurisdiction? Are you just flat out saying that your opinion is that we have no jurisdiction act under state law, therefore we can't do anything with this docket?
Well, it's my opinion, Commissioner Sarre, that clearly the commission does not have the statutory authority to interpret the statute dealing with whether or not an obligation exists. So then the question is, does this commission have jurisdiction over an avoided cost proceeding that has been delegated to it by PURPA? I had not arrived at that conclusion and would like to have time to perhaps go back and look at the statutes with that thought in mind. When I wrote this in our comments on Friday, I was thinking only of the only as it dealt with the question of whether or not an obligation existed, and it dovetailed in with my point that I did not think that it was a question that's properly before the commission. But nonetheless, I agree with you that the natural logical progression of the position that I have taken would indicate that perhaps there would be no jurisdiction to address an avoided cost proceeding as well. I understand that could flow from the position I've taken. I'm not 100% sure I would want to say that, but I'm 90% sure that I guess I'd say it because it flows from the point that it flows from the position we've taken. Yes.
Thank you.
John, do you have an additional question?
Yeah, and I think this is a short one. I mean, the commission, in order to fulfill its responsibilities under an avoided cost determination, must, of necessity, render decisions concerning what the, quote, obligations of various parties are from a regulatory standpoint under the PURPA law and FERC's regulations, must it not?
But here we're being asked to determine what the term obligation means within the specific context of the new PURPA Act, and I think that's different. You're being asked to make a decision as a matter of law as to what this statute says.
Are we? Well, I guess we are.
Yeah. And I think that's up to PURPA. It's there.
Well, that may be the case.
Yeah.
I mean, it necessarily is the case, but it may also mean that we're being asked to render a decision as to what the obligation is under the original, whether an obligation arose under the original PURPA law.
That's exactly the issue, I believe.
I think that what we're talking about is the savings statute, and what does the term obligation or contract pending before a state commission mean as it relates to this proceeding and whether or not it can go forward. And I believe that is the question that's before this commission, and I believe that it does not have jurisdiction to answer that question.
Thank you.
And I do just want to note, I haven't formulated any sort of opinion on jurisdiction. I just thought it was an interesting question that had been raised, and certainly, you know, one that's important for any tribunal to grapple with. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm tipping one way or the other necessarily. I've got an open mind on it, but since it came up in the context of today's motion, I thought it was important to address.
Well, and we may very well find out what South Dakota Supreme Court thinks about that eventually.
Commissioner Johnson, did you have a question?
I have a comment. If there are any other questions, they should go first.
Any other questions? If not, please.
Just as a procedural matter, Mr. Chairman, I have some questions for our general counsels with regard to these jurisdictional issues, and unless we're under some incredible time constraint, we'd prefer we take this matter under advisement rather than rule from the rule today.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson, and I will be off the record for a moment. I was going to suggest that for a period of time that we go into executive session on this, and then as I looked at it further, it seemed to make sense to place this at the end of the agenda and take all of the others while everybody else is waiting and then go into executive session if we're going to do that. And now it appears that it might make sense for us to say thank you very much for all of the information that you provided for us, and we'll put this on a later date. What is the desire of the commission? Excuse me?
This is Karen Kramer from staff. The hearing is scheduled for November 2nd through 5th,
okay.
I believe.
So we really should have an executive session at the end of this meeting. And
our next commission meeting would be
November
1st, right?
Right.
So.
Right.
Mr. Chairman,
just a minute. There's an ad hoc when? It's potential for an ad hoc Thursday morning. Is that?
I'd be interested in doing this, but I'd want to do it on the record. But I wouldn't mind going into executive session at the end of the hearing. I understand the importance of concluding the business. I don't know how long we have the bridges for, but we get through the other bridges or business, depending on Sherry and the calls, then go into executive session. It could be very, very short. I just want to ask, I think on some of these things I could be willing to move on the motions. I just want to have a couple questions for General Counsel.
Right. And those are the options. One is to go into executive session at the end of this. The other is to go and have an ad hoc on Thursday. Commissioner Johnson, do you have
Not exactly, because, you could have, yes, I think those are options, but also if we go into executive session, we might be able to make some determinations on the pending issues, and certainly there might be other issues to take up on Thursday, but I don't think they're necessarily mutually exclusive.
Given we have a number of time constraints, given that, I'd be willing to go into executive session. I am optimistic that I'd be able to rule at the end of that, although I can't make any promises.
Let's go into executive session after the end of this meeting, after we've taken up the other items, and we'll determine during that meeting what we will be doing, whether we'll be going into a Thursday ad hoc or not.
And Mr. Chairman, not to be a nitpicker, probably that should be on the record.
Yes.
If we're going to do that.
Yeah. I'm not making a motion. What I'm doing is just having a discussion right now so we can get to that, so we can go back.
I just don't want to forget it. Do you mind?
We're going to go back on record right now.
I would move that at the end of.
Do you want them?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that at the end of the regular PUC hearing that we move into, go into executive session in this docket.
Did you have that on record? Thank you. I second the motion.
Concur.
Next item before us is item EL-05022. In the matter of application by Otter Tail Power Company on behalf of Big Stone 2 co-owners of an energy conversion facility permit for the construction of the Big Stone 2 project. The question before the commission is, today shall the commission grant the local review committee's request for $47,959 in order to hire a consultant?
I'll take that, Chairman.
Michelle?
As part of this docket, statutorily a local review committee was established, and their task is to determine what the effects this project would have on their communities in that area. The local review committee consists primarily of elected officials who participate in a part-time capacity as those officials and have full-time positions of employment. And they're requesting the ability to hire a consultant in order to gather the information and prepare a report. And staff would agree that it would probably be a prudent move for them to hire a consultant. Staff looked at the proposal. The hours seem appropriate. The cost per hour that they're paying the consultant does not appear out of line. And the only correction I would make is their math is a little bit off. It should be $47,950. I'm not sure where that extra $9 came in. But staff would recommend the commission approve this request.
Thank you, Michelle. Is there anyone else who needs to be heard on this item? If not.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
This is Chris Madsen on behalf of Big Stone 2 Project. And for the record, I would just note that the project has objection to the local review committee's request.
Thank you, Chris. Is there anyone else? If not, I will move that the commission grant the local review committee's request for $47,950 in order to hire a consultant.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question.
All right.
And if I could get you to hold off on your motion for just a bit. Thank you very much. Do we have anybody who's familiar with the process that was used to choose these consultants?
I'm not overly familiar with how they chose this particular consultant, but I know that they had contacted our office a month or so ago, and the first person that they had brought up, staff felt there was a conflict of interest between them and previous work they had done regarding this particular project. We were not involved in a bid process or in the decision process.
And just as a statement, I think I'd be willing to dive more into the specifics about how the selection, you know, whether it went out to RFP, whether it was a competitive bid process, but I do want to provide, you know, maximum feasible deference to the local review committee in their selection process. So I do have some concerns, but I'll set them aside in this instance.
Any other questions?
I will second the motion.
And I concur. Thank you for your patience, Mr. Chairman.
No problem. Natural gas, NG05-007, in the matter of the filing by Mid-American Energy Company for approval of continuation of the IGSPP. Question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the continuation of Mid-American's IGSPP? Dave.
Chairman, thank you. Commissioners, staff. My name is Dave Bader. I'm Director of Gas Supply Planning for Mid-American Energy. And I just wanted to make a couple comments. We requested in this extension that it be granted for 5 years. Based upon the last time that we had come before the commission for extension, it was suggested why didn't we ask for a longer time period. So that is just kind of a side comment there. The program that we filed for is identical to the program that is currently approved in the state, and really, I just want to make one comment because I know time is important here. Beginning Northern Natural Gas's rate case was active for a number of years, and when we made a filing, actually made the last three filings for awards beginning in November of 2003. That rate case was ongoing. There was no settlement to it. We elected rather than to use the rates that were currently in effect. We talked with staff and filed based upon a 13.25% increase of Northern's rate case of their over and above their October 31, 2003 rates. That case was settled June 25th of 2005. The FERC ordered that June 25th, 2005. So for the last three filings, we used rates which were prospective, I guess, is the best way to think about it. Based upon Northern's offer, it wasn't just a guess, but it was based upon their offer as they had proposed in settlement processes. Also, we had agreed with the commission, with the staff, that we would make a true-up filing for the difference between the rates that we used during that time period and the settlement rates as were approved June 25th. I'd like to say that we will proceed ahead and make that true-up filing prior to the next six-month filing, which would be February 28th of 2006. So we would we'll go ahead and make that true-up filing as soon as we can. We have generally looked at it. We have not gone through the process of recreating the filings at this point in time, but it appears that there will be some of the award, I'd say a small amount, but a piece of the award that MidAmerican had received that will be sent back to the PGA as a result of that. And again, that's very preliminary at this point in time, but we'll get that filing done, which would account for the last 3 6-month filings that we did.
Thank you.
Yes.
Dave, are you taking this?
I don't know if that was clear to the commission what he was saying, but just to simplify it maybe, what he's saying is that the last award numbers that you saw on the report may not be are not really indicative because they were based on estimated rates that the company thought would result from the Northern Natural Gas rate case. Now that rate case has been settled, and it appears to the company that the final rates will offer would have offered a lower sharing amount to the company than is reflected in my reports and in their reports, if that makes sense.
It does. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, and obviously looking at the reports, the amount retained by the company increased towards the end, and that is an explanation of why that happened. Other than that, staff did prepare a memo. It's got some numbers, some confidential information if you want specifics on some of that. Within that, there were a couple of numbers that looked didn't quite mesh, and it had to do with my result sheet that showed the 4 separate categories of costs that are analyzed. There's a couple numbers, and all I'll say right now, the answer to those have been resolved to staff's satisfaction. If you want to know more about that, we could certainly speak privately about that, but we did receive satisfactory answers on why in one period there was a large number in one group and a large number in another group that tended to offset each other, and if you can recall what I'm referring to. But that was answered to our satisfaction. With that explanation of why some of the numbers appeared towards the end of the reporting period, I just answer any other questions or concerns that you had that can be discussed non-confidentially, if you have any.
Thank you, Dave. Are there any questions?
Yeah, and I would, first ask generally if this is confidential information. If it is, then certainly I'll try to rephrase. But of the 4 cost areas, there is one area that has had consistently better performance. Can we speak generally about that area without violating any confidential treatment?
Generally.
Specifically in the reservation charges, there's been consistently, high performance. Does it beg the question whether or not the benchmark is appropriate?
That is certainly, up to you to determine. If you look at our Mid-American service territory to Sioux Falls, that is served off of Northern Natural Gas. If we were serving only Sioux Falls, we would not be getting any discount at all for service to Sioux Falls. So, in the PGA process, where we're able to get those discounts is through competitive markets throughout the rest of Mid-America's service territory, where there are a number of pipelines serving those competitive markets, and so we're able to negotiate for lower reservation rates in other parts of the service territory, which in fact benefit South Dakota dramatically in those reservations.
And I am fond of incentive plans, and it appears here as though that plan's been very successful.
Yes.
Is that practice you described, is that the kind of thing that companies wouldn't do if there weren't an incentive in place?
That's a good question. Would they do it? I think they would do to some extent. We have a staff that is extremely diligent in negotiating those contracts, and I think our discounts are very good, actually. So we're incented to do that through the incentive program, obviously, and we have a desire to get the lowest rate we can for the PGA customer, and I think the incentive program does provide that.
Mid-American, if I'm right, has natural gas customers in four states, Illinois, Iowa, South Dakota, and then just a few in Nebraska.
Right.
Are plans like this, I know that it's in effect, a similar plan's in effect in Iowa. What about Illinois and Nebraska?
Only Iowa and South Dakota.
With the Iowa plan, are there any substantive differences between how it's implemented in Iowa versus South Dakota?
Yeah. The dead bands are... The dead bands, meaning the difference from where the reservation fee and the actual fees are vastly different. The dead band in Iowa is smaller than the dead band is in South Dakota. South Dakota has a much larger dead band. Also, the calculation of the reference fee is different. The calculation, the use of the supply premium gets included into actual costs in South Dakota. It does not in Iowa. So there are some differences, some of which are beneficial, some of which may favor South Dakota, some of which may favor Iowa. But there are differences in the programs, yes.
And from a staff perspective, obviously fully aware of all of those differences in Iowa, and you're confident that this is the best approach for South Dakota?
Well, in the past, South Dakota has, rather than following the Iowa path, which relies heavily on comparing the results of, I believe, a two-year earlier period, rather... He compares the results of action or results that happened 2 years earlier compared to what's currently being experienced. We've, in analysis of that type of method, what that tends to do is stop rewarding the company for a long-term pipeline negotiated contract, which may deserve an ongoing reward because of actions taken at that time. There are probably external factors that can happen that can influence what the reward is and really not reflect the amount of effort that Mid-American puts into current negotiations or not. When we modified Mid-American's plan instead of following the Iowa approach, which basically cuts off the incentive after a short period of time, we tended to just observe the results and shift the sharing mechanism graph, if you want to call it that, or spread appropriately to what we thought was a more challenging incentive for Mid-American at that time. Since that time, the results have come in under that new sharing mechanism, and it's a difficult question to say what's the exactly appropriate spread of incentive and where exactly that should be at any given time. As I was talking about earlier, when you talk about the reservation charges, those are specifically the northern natural gas charges, and so that's why we wanted to bring up that issue about the rate case skewing the results of the more recent results reported. And I think that according to what the company has said today, that the actual sharing amount with MidAmerican as a result of Northern's rate case being concluded will diminish. I mean, it won't be as big as you saw in the results that recorded, because now that rate case has been settled and is final. We won't know the exact result of that because MidAmerican is still going through the computation of how those new settlement rates were going to affect. Right at this time, we can't quantify how much it would have changed MidAmerican's award. We're still waiting for those numbers. They will be coming out, I assume, within a short period of time, and we would be able to better see what the exact end result will be of the sharing mechanism, which you really don't know now. They have indicated that, like I said, it will be somewhat lower, or they expect it to be, that their award will be lower.
And staff is comfortable with the 5-year term of this proposal?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the awards that have been shown have been consistent enough, considering this Northern Natural Gas rate case that we just talked about, that I really wouldn't expect anything. I mean, I would expect kind of the same level of challenge to MidAmerican and the same type of rewards. I don't see it going wild and becoming huge or something like that.
Commissioner, you had asked the question about the differences between Iowa and South Dakota. I left out another category, I think, which is important, and that is in the Iowa program there is a cap. There's an annual cap. I'm sorry I didn't include that.
Thank you very much. And
I'd just add one more thing. When they talk about jurisdictional sharing or separation of actually what you're talking about is load factor characteristics between states, whether they share that as a total company PGA type of thing or whether they separate the individual load factors of each individual state. Not all of our companies do that. MidAmerican did. And, I'll just say that because of that, it has had a significant impact on lowering our gas costs by sharing in the better load factor that Iowa has than South Dakota does.
Well, and I've come to grips with the fact that, there are certain things you can't know, and we really can't know to what extent the incentive means that MidAmerican is doing things that they would never otherwise do, but it's also difficult to argue with results. I mean, $14.5 million of essentially savings to ratepayers certainly seems worth the $4 million investment in MidAmerican. And, Mr. Chairman, unless anybody's got anything else, I'd have a motion when it's appropriate.
I don't see any other questions. Go right ahead with your motion.
I would just move the commission approve the refund plan.
Second.
And I concur.
And I
would also thank staff for the briefing material. That memo aided greatly in my understanding of this, so thanks.
And just to clarify, you meant the incentive gas program.
Oh, yes, my apology, the IGSPP. That's 2 weeks in a row now.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to NG05-011 in the matter of the filing by Northwestern Corporation doing business as Northwestern Energy for approval of a refund plan. Today the question before the commission is to approve the refund plan. I understand there may be a request to remove this.
Yes, the company has contacted us and requested we just defer it until the next meeting. They wanted certain personnel to be here that could not make it to this meeting.
All right. It will be deferred, unless there is an objection, it will be deferred to the next meeting. Administrative, in the matter of potential revisions and or additions to the Commission's switched access rules codified in ARSD 2010-27 through 2010-29, the question before the commission is, shall the commission open a rulemaking docket?
I will start off with that. Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. I would anticipate, because it's rulemaking, again, you can ask anyone on staff and anyone on the phone. I think there are a number of people on the phone. To make this short, on the agenda, you'll see, you heard that from comments last week, a number of the parties contemplated, should this be a rulemaking with switched access to solve the problem? If there is a problem with the switched access rules, in particular special access. So what staff would like to see done is we believe that there is a solution out there. We just need to bring everybody to the table and hear from all the parties what their view is on what the problem is from their perspective and how to solve that problem. It just can't be, here's the problem. What we need to hear from people is, and here's our solution. Understanding that not everyone may walk away happy, but everyone will walk away with something. Staff believes that rather than litigating these matters, that a less formal bring everybody to the table type of scenario would work better here. At that point, and what I'm thinking is commissioners, all interested parties, and we sit around and they discuss it. They can tell us again what they see as the problem and the solution. At that point, then the commissioners can decide if they want to go forward with a rule change, and at that point give some direction what they would like to see changed in the rules. They can decide, no, the rules are fine as they are. I'm sure one of the things everyone will bring up is, well, you know, the FCC is about to do something with this, but again, we've heard that for a number of years. But I think it does come into play, and maybe people have information out there more current than what I have, and maybe they truly are ready to make a decision on this. So that is what staff, why it's on the agenda today, and again, you may want to hear from other parties out there.
Thank you, Karen. Are there any questions of Karen at this time? If not, are there other parties who would like to be heard from on this issue?
This is Dave Corzeppa from AT&T. Whenever it's appropriate, we would like to be heard.
Please, Dave, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. I'll try to make this brief, although I got to thank you for maybe some extra CLE credits on FERC. that I was listening to earlier.
Send your check to the PUC.
Problem. We kind of had a discussion about this a little bit last week, and we really do appreciate this being on the agenda this week, and we were pleased to see it. One of the things I discussed last week that was the fact that although AT&T had followed the procedural lead of Mid-Continent and I believe also MCI in intervening in the LECA dockets, like a switched access cost case dockets I'm referring to, we do believe that those cases offer only a limited opportunity to address the issues at stake concerning switched access because of both the fact that there's a limited number of parties involved in those 2005 access cases, and I think more importantly, I think those cases could have potentially at least a limited scope that would not allow us to address our main issue, which is the failure of these LECA companies to pass the commission's imputation rules. Therefore, AT&T supports a generic rulemaking, although I don't want to say conditionally, but we certainly have some strong suggestions, two strong suggestions that we believe are critical to ensure the success of any rulemaking. And that's first, that the timing of those cases complete in 4 to 6 months, or you know, I would reference the end of the 2005 LECA dockets as probably the time frames that you probably should be thinking about. And secondly, I saw on the agenda item the fact that the commission was interested in discussing here today potentially the scope of those dockets. And AT&T believes the scope of the rulemaking has to be broad enough to allow for whatever rules that come out of there to be targeted at ensuring the enforcement of the currently applicable imputation requirements in South Dakota. In fact, we would say that the scope of the DACA should really be broad enough to allow parties to bring up whatever issues they believe are relevant. In terms of timing, I want to talk about that a little bit. Any rulemaking will need to be complete, as I stated, prior to the 2005 LECA switched access rate cases completing. And timing is critical for competitive reasons as well. AT&T and all other IXCs are being harmed every day in the marketplace by the LECA switched access rates. And the LECA carriers' switch access rates fail the South Dakota imputation rules, by any measure. I think I talked about this last week as well. LECA carriers charge AT&T and other IXCs, that's inter-exchange carriers or long-distance toll carriers. They charge us 14 cents per minute of use for all intrastate toll calls made by AT&T customers, and that's on each end, which means that if our customer makes a toll call placed between two LECA carriers, we're paying those LECA carriers on each end 14 cents a minute, or compositely 28 cents a minute, for every intrastate call they place between those carriers. And we've done some research on this, and as far as we can tell, all or nearly all the LECA carriers compete against AT&T in the intrastate toll market in South Dakota through themselves or their affiliates offering those services. And we also did research on what they're pricing those services on at a retail basis, and we found that the rates they offer are 5 to 14 cents per minute of use. I mean, as small as 5 cents. Clearly, we can't compete on that basis. When we're paying them 14 to 28 cents a minute per minute of use, and they're competing against us at rates at or lower than that. And that's exactly the result, the bad result, that the South Dakota imputation rules were designed to avoid. If they're offering retail long-distance rates far below their switched access rates, they cannot possibly be passing those imputation standards, which require them to impute to themselves their own retail rates their switched access costs. And I'll try to make my comments a lot briefer than what I originally prepared by just saying in conclusion that the LECA switched access rates are running competitive IXCs out of South Dakota and competition with them. Competition wasn't about LECA companies competing against LECA wireless companies for long-distance customers. It was supposed to be much broader than that, and it should be. AT&T believes something needs to change and change in very short order. We therefore support a rulemaking with the two suggestions I've described. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate your remarks. Darla?
Thank you. Darla Rogers representing LECA and the LEX. I would just briefly say that I've been trying to weigh on behalf of LECA and the LEX kind of the pros and cons of a rulemaking docket in this procedure as is proposed on the agenda. And on the pro side, it appears to me that this is a rulemaking procedure or an investigation or however you want to describe it, is a more appropriate forum to actually study any deficiencies that have been noted in the cost study methodologies. And I think we mentioned that in our oppositions to the intervention in the individual dockets. The second advantage or the pro part of it, I think, is that it brings all the parties to the table. You know, some of the companies have not filed cost studies, and there are companies like Fort Randall and Prairie Wave who are not members of LECA, and so their ability to have any input in anything that's discussed in those regards would be limited just with the interventions. I think on the con side, the biggest thing that I see is the timing. There are significant outstanding issues at the FCC level, and, you know, intercarrier compensation being obviously the most overwhelming. And I think that maybe this is not the best time to engage in a rulemaking docket at the state level. If, however, you do choose to go down this path, I would encourage you to conduct a rulemaking procedure in such a manner that does not ignore events that are occurring at the federal level. And if you could structure timelines of this docket in such a way that you do not force companies to engage in time-consuming proceedings at the state level that may be dramatically changed or influenced by events that occur at the federal level. So those are our comments. However the commission wishes to proceed, we will be at the table and cooperate fully. Thank you.
Thank you. Rich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. Richard Coit on behalf of SDTA. I would agree with Darla's comments. I would just like to share a little bit of additional information. or comment on I guess some of the potential issues that could come up in this rulemaking if it's opened. We agree that, you know, a rulemaking is certainly the appropriate proceeding if the intent is to consider take input on possible changes to the current rules or with the regulatory policy behind those rules. We certainly do, I guess we would encourage the commission, though, that if that is done, that you do carefully consider the timelines that are part of that process, as well as the scope. Very clearly, as you're all aware, we've got intercarrier compensation proceedings pending at the federal level. And a main objective in those proceedings is to unify inter- and intrastate rates, and also to unify the rates that are charged for reciprocal compensation and switched access. There are a lot of different proposals in the pending federal proceeding as to the costing standards that should be used if we're going to try to unify these rates. We have costing standards that are different today on the interstate side, on the intrastate side, that are different between reciprocal rates and intrastate rates. And as I said, the objective is to unify all of the rates. If that is the objective, very clearly on the federal side, at least there's a pretty good likelihood that there's going to be some dictates as to what the standard should be and what sort of cost allocation should be utilized in arriving at that unified rate. So when you start looking at the scope of this proceeding and the timelines in this proceeding, I think it's important, you know, to keep all of that in mind. As Darla mentioned, I think our big concern with timing is not having to undertake a tremendous amount of effort and trying to come up with revisions to the current rules that in large part right now would be based on some speculation as to what we think the federal rules are going to ultimately be. With respect to the timing on the federal intercarrier comp, I guess, who knows when that's going to be completed. We've heard a lot about when it's going to be completed, a lot of ideas when the FCC wants to complete it. I've heard middle of next year. Personally, I think that's probably a little optimistic, and it's probably going to be a little later next year. With a lot of the other things that have come up and taken the FCC's attention. But I think that it's probably not crazy to assume that maybe by the end of next year there will be something coming out of the FCC on the issues of intercarrier compensation. The other thing that I just want to comment on, and I think this gets to the scope issue as well, if you look at the states that have reformed intrastate access rates and that have been in a position to substantially reduce those rates, you know, every state is different. But we in South Dakota are definitely a high-cost state. And if you look at some of the neighboring states that are high-cost states, they've approached access reform in different ways. Nebraska was able to substantially reduce their intrastate access rates, and they had to do that through the implementation of a state universal service fund. And that's what enabled them to reduce the rates and at the same time preserve universal service and really avoid rate shock to the end users in terms of their local service rates. Wyoming has approached things a little bit differently, and I think some of you are probably aware of some of the local rate universal service issues that have popped up over in Wyoming. But I don't think in the process of looking at the rules you can dodge the universal service issues. They are there, and I think when you're looking at the scope of these things, we do not have a state universal service fund currently in South Dakota. As those of you who have followed the history on the legislation, staff, you're aware that efforts have been made in the past to get a state universal service fund, and it's not been successful to this point. But these decisions on the rules, just encourage you to look at the scope, consider very carefully the scope, and to keep in mind that there are some universal service concerns that need to be addressed. And with that, I stop my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard on this item?
Yeah, this is Mark Colling speaking for Quest Communications. I'm a Switch Access product manager. I only have a couple points. First of all, Quest has maintained rates that are much lower than electric companies, so I think if you wanted to investigate a specific rate case, you should really focus on companies who have changed their rates and not allow AT&T just to go on a fishing expedition. I also want to reiterate or agree with points several of the other people have made as far as the inter-carrier compensation docket. Quest has been very involved in that, and I know they've missed a lot of deadlines going on for years. But it is we are trying to look at it in a unified rate structure for not only access intrastate, but wireless, wireline interconnection rates. So I would hope that anything we do in South Dakota would keep in mind the fact that there are other dockets and other proposals out there. Maybe Kent's proposal also, I'm sure that South Dakota probably worked on that. And finally, as was mentioned earlier, in Nebraska, there's a state universal service fund draw from that fund that impacted our rates. So any changes in access rates or revenues, South Dakota, West would want to be revenue neutral. So we'd want to try to recover that revenue somewhere else, and universal service fund could be the way to go.
Thank you. Mr. Gerdes?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, my name is Dave Gerdes, and I represent Mid-Continent Communications. My partner, Brett Kenneke, represents MCI, who has authorized me to speak for his client, MCI. And in both cases, our clients are in favor of this as being a good step toward solving a problem that we talked to you about not too long ago when we intervened in the LECA dockets.
Anyone else wishing to testify on this item? Commissioners, any questions?
I was just going to ask if there were any staff comments other than those that were offered by Ms. Kramer.
This is Keith Sanger from Commission staff. I personally have mixed feelings about a rules hearing or a rules docket of some sort. It is true that the Commission rules, access rules, are probably over 10 years old and have not kept up with the rapid changing technology and the investment of investment deployment being made from our Rule X. So it may be time for a rules review. However, currently there's a lot going on at the FCC, as we've talked about just a little while ago, on intercarrier compensation. I would hate to see months of Commission time, thousands of hours of company consultant and legal fees and time be wasted by being preempted of some sort by what the FCC might do. I also believe that the key factor in some of the interventions, and particularly staff's concerns that we have with the current dockets, has to do with the deployment of broadband and of those technologies and the method of allocation of that broadband. Currently, our rules do not address anything regarding allocation when we start talking broadband. It appears to me from working on these cases for a number of years that the rural ILEX and the consultants seem to take the fact that there are no rules telling us how to allocate, that no allocation is needed to broadband. Staff does not believe that's the case. We've been attacking this for the last couple of years as a cost causer pays or making sure that allocations are being made. Staff definitely does not want to see switch access to become a catch-all. We believe that, you know, a method of allocating using, you know, cost accounting principles for joint facilities, you know, need to be allocated to all those services being provided over those facilities. Our South Dakota rural LECs have been doing a great job of providing broadband to very rural areas of South Dakota. This provides a desired and needed service to our South Dakota customers. It promotes economic development. It betters the quality of life. The only missing thing we have is how do we pay for that? Staff is not trying to slow the deployment of these broadband services by anything that we've been doing or been asking to happen. But it just seems that our rules were written when POTS was the driving force, when POTS was king. I'm not so sure that that stands today. You know, there's little doubt that our ILECs are facing a lot of difficulties, phantom traffic, falling MOUs, and how do we pay for these deployment of new facilities. But we're rapidly approaching a time when carriers are going to be and have been pulling out of the state. We've seen this already. It seems that in today's world of unlimited calling minutes for $50 a month and unlimited broadband usage for $30 a month, it seems strange to me that we're still charging on a per-minute basis, 28 cents a minute to terminate calls, as was just brought out a little while ago. And in return, we're getting unlimited broadband for a fraction of that cost, depending on minutes, of course. But this, what I just talked about, is a big policy issue. I believe that that requires some sort of rules review by this commission. But I would like to see, as was commented earlier, that we do that cautiously in paying attention to what the FCC does. But that doesn't help where we stand today. Today we have currently a number of open dockets before us. I'm reluctant to say that a rules review at this point is going to help us anywhere with those. I think that some of those issues, specific issues in the specific cases, are better addressed in a rate case hearing setting before the commission, such has been done in the natural gas and electric rate cases over a number of years. The other problem that I see with rules is that it's almost impossible to find a one-size-fits-all solution. It's almost impossible to treat West River Advice in the same way we treat Alliance Communications or various other rural LECs in the state. Rules would limit staff's and the commission's ability to do the right things for the IXCs, to do the right things for the ILECs, and to do the right things for the South Dakota customers. If we do have a rules hearing, I believe staff could benefit immensely from some commission guidance. Additionally, it may be beneficial for some rules to be drafted as to what kind of support that has to be filed with the cost studies. Currently, we're getting cost studies filed with absolutely no support and causes for the cost studies to be drug out. And then when we do get support, there's no explanation of what numbers on 1,000 pieces of paper actually mean. So it's kind of a daunting task. So I think if we do dive into a rules hearing, we could speed the process up, the actual cost studies up with rules such as that, and maybe then address the broadband. I guess what I'm saying, generically speaking, is that, you know, on a policy issue, I do believe we need to move forward with a rules hearing on a case-by-case basis for the ones that are before us today. I think those should be done in a hearing setting if the companies and staff can't come to agreement, including the interveners. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, am I right? My assumption would be that any rules we do would be, you know, forward-looking and wouldn't have any effect on any dockets already filed. Is that right?
That was my assumption.
Karen, did you have anything? Okay. Anyone else have any? John?
I just had maybe a question for the gentleman from AT&T and maybe Mr. Gerdes too. What would be your fee? I mean, would we be just wasting our time? I mean, because this thing will be an enormous expenditure of effort by everybody, including us. If we don't know what the rules of the game are we just spinning our wheels in looking at this stuff at this point in time?
Till we know. Dave Corzeppa, and my response is based on I've been doing telecom now for about 10 years, and I cannot think of a debate where one party didn't propose delaying because of FCC action. And I think in many cases, what we got out of the FCC was action that came much later than anyone might have expected, or action that was subject to continuous appeals and legal debate. I think if you wait for the FCC, you're going to put the state of competition in paralysis, and you're going to force carriers to make the decision of whether or not to exit the state of South Dakota within the next with no, and I think even the gentleman from the South Dakota Telecommunications Association's comments highlight the fact that no one could predict when the FCC might act on these issues, especially for smaller ICOs. And that those smaller ICOs certainly have an incentive to delay any FCC action. So no one can predict that might happen. And I think that you have, at the same time, an immediate need for a competitive solution in South Dakota for these access charges. And I see no reason why, if the FCC acts 2-3 years down the road, that we can't reconvene and ensure that our the manner in which South Dakota addressed switched access is consistent with the action. And, in fact, I see no reason why we can't consider that during the debate now. I mean, I think AT&T will take a position here that will be consistent with whatever position it'd be taking on a national level at the FCC. Hope that makes sense.
Mr. Smith, I don't want to go over what Mr. Corzeppa said, but in my view anyway, this is has been a problem for quite some time. It will be a problem in the future, and it needs to be addressed, and there's no better time than the present.
Thank you. Anyone further at this time? Anyone who's joined us by telephone? Or left? Is the commission right? I'm prepared to make a motion. I'm just wondering whether you guys are comfortable or not. I will move that the commission shall open a rulemaking docket.
Mr. Chairman, I will second, and I do want to just say this. I think there are some old rules that clearly could be cleaned up at a minimum, and, you know, I'm going to personally keep an open mind about the scope and breadth of this, and especially watch what's going on at the federal level. And it kind of goes without saying, I'm sure we all feel that way, but at the same time, if we go the full-blown route, we all know that we're talking about substantial time and money and those sort of things. So I think we all just have to keep being mindful of what's going on at the federal level and make sure that we're not going to be doing work that's going to be undermined by what's happened on that level.
And I'll concur, and I'm also concerned about the timing and agree with everybody that we'll need to keep a cautious eye toward activity in D.C. Thank you.
With that, we have before we go through any announcements, we have a motion to go into executive session, which we will do now. I usually hesitate to say it's only going to be a few minutes, because when you say that, then it's longer. But I do anticipate this to be a short executive session. On the record now, I will move that the commission grant a continuance until FERC has released its decision in Alliant Energy Corporate Services Incorporated in relationship to EL04-016.
Second.
I concur.
Thank you all very much for working with us through that process. Announcements. The next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be held November 1st in this room at 1:30 p.m. Commission meetings are scheduled for December 6th and 20th as well. A hearing in docket EL04-016 will be held November 2 through 4, 2005 at 9 a.m. And a hearing in docket CT05-001 will be held November 7 through 9 in this room as well at 10 a.m. The meeting is adjourned.